reason and sanity, tending to plunge human life into hopeless chaos. To most, perhaps, the immediate sense of release has given a brief exhilaration to be followed by the deepest anxiety. For if all is relative, if life is a torrent without form or goal, in whose flood absolutely nothing save change itself can last, it seems to be something in which there is no future, and thus no hope. Human beings appear to be happy just so long as they have a future to which they can look forward, whether it be a good time tomorrow or an everlasting life beyond the grave. For various reasons, more and more people find it hard to believe in the latter. On the other hand, the former has the disadvantage that when this good time arrives, it is difficult to enjoy it to the full without some promise of more to come. If happiness always depends on something expected in the future, we are chasing a will-o'-the-wisp that ever eludes our grasp, until the future and ourselves vanish into the abyss of death. As a matter of fact, our age is no more insecure than any other. Poverty, disease, war, change, and death are nothing new. In the best of times, security has never been more than temporary and apparent. But it has been possible to make the insecurity of human life supportable by belief in unchanging things beyond the reach of calamity. In God, in man's immortal soul, and in the government of the universe by eternal laws of right. Today, such convictions are rare, even in religious circles. There is no level of society, there must even be few individuals, touched by modern education where there is not some trace of the leaven of doubt. It is simply self-evident that during the past century, the authority of science has taken the place of the authority of religion in the popular imagination, and that skepticism, at least in spiritual things, has become more general than belief. The decay of belief has come about through the honest doubt, the careful and fearless thinking of highly intelligent men of science and philosophy. Moved by a zeal and reverence for facts, they have tried to see, understand, and face life as it is without wishful thinking. Yet for all that they have done to improve the conditions of life, their picture of the universe seems to leave the individual without ultimate hope. The price of their miracles in this world has been the disappearance of the world to come, and one is inclined to ask the old question, what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his soul? Logic, intelligence, and reason are satisfied, but the heart goes hungry, for the heart has learned to feel that we live for the future. Science may, slowly and uncertainly, give us a better future, for a few years, and then for each of us, it will end. It will all end. However long postponed, everything composed must decompose. Despite some opinions to the contrary, this is still the general view of science. In literary and religious circles, it is now often supposed that the conflict between science and belief is a thing of the past. There are even some rather wishful scientists who feel that when modern physics abandoned a crude atomistic materialism, the chief reasons for this conflict were removed. But this is not at all the case. In most of our great centers of learning, those who make it their business to study the full implications of science and its methods are as far as ever from what they understand as a religious point of view. Nuclear physics and relativity have, it is true, done away with the old materialism, but they now give us a view of the universe in which there is even less room for ideas of any absolute purpose or design. The modern scientist is not so naive as to deny God because he cannot be found with a telescope, or the soul because it is not revealed by the scalpel. He has merely noted that the idea of God is logically unnecessary. He even doubts that it has any meaning. It does not help him to explain anything which he cannot explain in some other and simpler way. He argues that if everything which happens is said to be under the providence and control of God, this actually amounts to saying nothing. To say that everything is governed and created by God is like saying everything is up, which means nothing at all. The notion does not help us to make any verifiable predictions, and so, from the scientific standpoint, is of no value whatsoever. Scientists may be right in this respect. They may be wrong. It is not our purpose here to argue this point. We need only note that such skepticism has immense influence and sets the prevailing mood of the age. What science has said, in sum, is this: we do not, and in all probability cannot, know whether God exists. Nothing that we do know suggests that he does, and all the arguments which claim to prove his existence are found to be without logical meaning. There is nothing indeed to prove that there is no God, but the burden of proof rests with those who propose the idea. If, the scientists would say, you believe in God, you must do so on purely emotional grounds, without basis in logical fact. Practically speaking, this may amount to atheism. Theoretically, it is simple agnosticism, for it is of the essence of scientific honesty that you do not pretend to know what you do not know, and of the essence of scientific method that you do not employ hypotheses which cannot be tested. The immediate results of this honesty have been deeply unsettling and depressing, for man seems to be unable to live without myth, without the belief that the routine and drudgery, the pain and fear of this life, have some meaning and goal in the future. At once, new myths come into being, political and economic myths with extravagant promises of the best of futures in the present world. These myths give the individual a certain sense of meaning by making him part of a vast social effort in which he loses something of his own emptiness and loneliness. Yet the very violence of these political religions betrays the anxiety beneath them, for they are but men huddling together and shouting to give themselves courage in the dark. Once there is the suspicion that a religion is a myth, its power has gone. It may be necessary for man to have a myth, but he cannot self-consciously prescribe one as he can mix a pill for a headache. A myth can only work when it is thought to be truth, and man cannot for long knowingly and intentionally kid himself. Even the best modern apologists for religion seem to overlook this fact, for their most forceful arguments for some sort of return to orthodoxy are those which show the social and moral advantages of belief in God. But this does not prove that God is a reality. It proves, at most, that believing in God is useful. If God did not exist, it would be necessary to invent him. Perhaps. But if the public has any suspicion that he does not exist, the invention is in vain. It is for this reason that most of the current return to orthodoxy in some intellectual circles has a rather hollow ring. So much of it is more a belief in believing than a belief in God. The contrast between the insecure, neurotic, educated, modern, and the quiet dignity and inner peace of the old-fashioned believer makes the latter a man to be envied. But it is a serious misapplication of psychology to make the presence or absence of neurosis the touchstone of truth, and to argue that if a man's philosophy makes him neurotic, it must be wrong. Most atheists and agnostics are neurotic, whereas most simple Catholics are happy and at peace with themselves. Therefore, the views of the former are false, and of the latter, true. Even if the observation is correct, the reasoning based on it is absurd. It is as if to say, you say there is a fire in the basement. You are upset about it. Because you are upset, there is obviously no fire. The agnostic, the skeptic, is neurotic, but this does not imply a false philosophy. It implies the discovery of facts to which he does not know how to adapt himself. The intellectual who tries to escape from neurosis by escaping from the facts is merely acting on the principle that where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise. When belief in the eternal becomes impossible, and there is only the poor substitute of belief in believing, men seek their happiness in the joys of time. However much they may try to bury it in the depths of their minds, they are well aware that these joys are both uncertain and brief. This has two results. On the one hand, there is the anxiety that one may be missing something, so that the mind flits nervously and greedily from one pleasure to another, without finding rest and satisfaction in any. On the other, the frustration of having always to pursue a future good in a tomorrow which never comes, and in a world where everything must disintegrate, gives men an attitude of, what's the use anyhow? Consequently, our age is one of frustration, anxiety, agitation, and addiction to dope. Somehow we must grab what we can while we can, and drown out the realization that the whole thing is futile and meaningless. This dope we call our high standard of living, a violent and complex stimulation of the senses, which makes them progressively less sensitive and thus in need of yet more violent stimulation. We crave distraction, a panorama of sights, sounds, thrills, and titillations into which as much as possible must be crowded in the shortest possible time. To keep up this standard, most of us are willing to put up with lives that consist largely in doing jobs that are a bore, earning the means to seek relief from the tedium by intervals of hectic and expensive pleasure. These intervals are supposed to be the real living, the real purpose, served by the necessary evil of work. Or we imagine that the justification of such work is the rearing of a family, to go on doing the same kind of thing, in order to rear another family, and so ad infinitum. This is no caricature. It is the simple reality of millions of lives, so commonplace that we need hardly dwell upon the details, save to note the anxiety and frustration of those who put up with it, not knowing what else to do. But what are we to do? The alternatives seem to be two. The first is, somehow or other, to discover a new myth or convincingly resuscitate an old one. If science cannot prove there is no God, we can try to live and act on the bare chance that he may exist after all. There seems to be nothing to lose in such a gamble, for if death is the end, we shall never know what we have lost. But obviously, this will never amount to a vital faith, for it is really no more than to say, since the whole thing is futile anyhow, let's pretend it isn't. The second is to try grimly to face the fact that life is a tale told by an idiot, and make of it what we can, letting science and technology serve us as well as they may in our journey from nothing to nothing. Yet these are not the only solutions. We may begin by granting all the agnosticism of a critical science. We may admit, frankly, that we have no scientific grounds for belief in God, in personal immortality, or in any absolutes. We may refrain altogether from trying to believe, taking life just as it is, and no more. From this point of departure, there is yet another way of life that requires neither myth nor despair. But it requires a complete revolution in our ordinary, habitual ways of thinking and feeling. The extraordinary thing about this revolution is that it reveals the truth behind the so-called myths of traditional religion and metaphysic. It reveals, not beliefs, but actual realities corresponding, in an unexpected way, to the ideas of God and of eternal life. There are reasons for supposing that a revolution of this kind was the original source of some of the main religious ideas, standing in relation to them as reality to symbol and cause to effect. The common error of ordinary religious practice is to mistake the symbol for the reality, to look at the finger pointing the way, and then to suck it for comfort rather than follow it. Religious ideas are like words, of little use and often misleading, unless you know the concrete realities to which they refer. The word water is a useful means of communication amongst those who know water. The same is true of the word and the idea called God. I do not, at this point, wish to seem mysterious or to be making claims to secret knowledge. The reality which corresponds to God and eternal life is honest, above board, plain, and open for all to see. But the seeing requires a correction of mind, just as clear vision sometimes requires a correction of the eyes. The discovery of this reality is hindered rather than helped by belief, whether one believes in God or believes in atheism. We must here make a clear distinction between belief and faith, because in general practice, belief has come to mean a state of mind which is almost the opposite of faith. Belief, as I use the word here, is the insistence that the truth is what one would leaf or wish it to be. The believer will open his mind to the truth on condition that it fits in with his preconceived ideas and wishes. Faith, on the other hand, is an unreserved opening of the mind to the truth, whatever it may turn out to be. Faith has no preconceptions. It is a plunge into the unknown. Belief clings, but faith lets go. In this sense of the word, faith is the essential virtue of science, and likewise of any religion that is not self-deception. Most of us believe in order to feel secure, in order to make our individual lives seem valuable and meaningful. Belief has thus become an attempt to hang on to life, to grasp and keep it for one's own. But you cannot understand life and its mysteries as long as you try to grasp it. Indeed, you cannot grasp it, just as you cannot walk off with a river in a bucket. If you try to capture running water in a bucket, it is clear that you do not understand it and that you will always be disappointed. For in the bucket, the water does not run. To have running water, you must let go of it and let it run. The same is true of life and of God. The present phase of human thought and history is especially ripe for this letting go. Our minds have been prepared for it by this very collapse of the beliefs in which we have sought security. From a point of view strictly, if strangely, in accord with certain religious traditions, this disappearance of the old rocks and absolutes is no calamity, but rather a blessing. It almost compels us to face reality with open minds, and you can only know God through an open mind, just as you can only see the sky through a clear window. You will not see the sky if you have covered the glass with blue paint. But religious people who resist the scraping of the paint from the glass, who regard the scientific attitude with fear and mistrust, and confuse faith with clinging to certain ideas, are curiously ignorant of laws of the spiritual life which they might find in their own traditional records. A careful study of comparative religion and spiritual philosophy reveals that abandonment of belief, of any clinging to a future life for one's own, and of any attempt to escape from finitude and mortality is a regular and normal stage in the way of the spirit. Indeed, this is actually such a first principle of the spiritual life that it should have been obvious from the beginning. And it seems, after all, surprising that learned theologians should adopt anything but a cooperative attitude towards the critical philosophy of science. Surely it is old news that salvation comes only through the death of the human form of God. But it was not, perhaps, so easy to see that God's human form is not simply the historic Christ, but also the images, ideas, and beliefs in the absolute to which man clings in his mind. Here is the full sense of the commandment, "Thou shalt not make to thyself any graven image, nor the likeness of anything that is in heaven above. Thou shalt not bow down to them, nor worship them." To discover the ultimate reality of life, the absolute, the eternal God, you must cease to try to grasp it in the forms of idols. These idols are not just crude images, such as the mental picture of God as an old gentleman on a golden throne. They are our beliefs, our cherished preconceptions of the truth, which block the unreserved opening of mind and heart to reality. The legitimate use of images is to express the truth, not to possess it. This was always recognized in the great Oriental traditions such as Buddhism, Vedanta, and Taoism. The principle has not been unknown to Christians, for it was implicit in the whole story and teaching of Christ. His life was, from the beginning, a complete acceptance and embracing of insecurity. The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. The principle is yet more to the point if Christ is regarded as divine in the most orthodox sense, as the unique and special incarnation of God. For the basic theme of the Christ story is that this express image of God becomes the source of life in the very act of being destroyed. To the disciples who tried to cling to his divinity in the form of his human individuality, he explained, "Unless a grain of corn fall into the ground and die, it remains alone. But if it dies, it brings forth much fruit." In the same vein, he warned them, "It is expedient for you that I go away. For if I go not away, the Paraclete, the Holy Spirit, cannot come unto you." These words are more than ever applicable to Christians and speak exactly to the whole condition of our times. For we have never actually understood the revolutionary sense beneath them, the incredible truth that what religion calls the vision of God is found in giving up any belief in the idea of God. By the same law of reversed effort, we discover the infinite and the absolute, not by straining to escape from the finite and relative world, but by the most complete acceptance of its limitations. Paradox as it may seem, we likewise find life meaningful only when we have seen that it is without purpose, and know the mystery of the universe only when we are convinced that we know nothing about it at all. The ordinary agnostic, relativist, or materialist fails to reach this point because he does not follow his line of thought consistently to its end, an end which would be the surprise of his life.